for over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
And we are back with an all-new episode of The Keep It Mysteries.
Ooh. Oh my God, it's been a minute. I've chosen to be Daphne for this one. So expect me in some purple with a little bit of a green ascot.
You're stealing Daphne from me?
Watch the way I stand. My hip structure, it's pure Daphne, top to bottom.
To be honest, I probably have more Fred qualities than I want to admit.
I could also see you in that color palette.
Absolutely. And joining us this week is the wonderful Francesca Ramsey.
Yay! Hello. Thanks for having
me. Welcome back.
Thanks.
To this episode, which really has a lot of suspense.
Oof.
A lot of mystery. A lot of crime.
Oh, edge of your seat. Stuff is happening.
Barbara Cartland.
Yeah.
Yes.
But before we get into that, though, we're introducing a new segment called Keep It Corrections.
Would you like to start? Keep it correct.
Imagine if we went through the corrections for all the previous 204 episodes of this show. We will not do that, but we're going to start with last week. I got some notes that Bomb Bitty Bomb is a Nicki Minaj and Nick Jonas song, not a Zayn song.
I don't know how I could have made that error.
You know, because he was also on the 50 Shades soundtrack with that sweeping boat song he did with Taylor Swift.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I could see Nick Jonas and Zayn are not similar, but I would say, like, in terms of relevance, maybe. Like,
yeah.
Who's thinking about either of them?
It's sort of right. Like they're both sexy, but not quite cool. I think that's sort of where you got lost.
Yeah.
Well, but, like yeah. Joe has remained for me the sexiest Jonas.
Really?
And also seems like the cooler one now. He's in his like muscle daddy phase. He's wearing like disco daddy, the designers on like, you know, sort of like glittery disco outfits at the Jonas shows. He's sort of giving like Harry Styles that
okay.
you want to fuck.
Yeah, I would definitely say he's cool because Nick really comes across as very like thirsty and needy and like please like me, you know, just like
it was the whole like gay baiting era.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, you know, and
then
Joe,
I know way too much about
hot.
His relationship, like truly it's
with Priyanka.
Just leave me
we
alone.
Know too much.
I just don't I don't care. I believe it. You guys are doing the sex, like I believe you. Leave me alone.
I want to say Joe has given interviews where he has made me laugh too, where I definitely I know Nick has not put on the I don't think he's been to a Second City class or anything. You know, he's not making me chortle.
Oh my
Plus,
god, yes.
DNCE was good.
Oh yeah.
Was good,
their
you know?
Their Do You Think I'm Sexy cover, underrated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, better than Paris Hilton's.
I mean, right. The bar is in hell, but yes, you are technically correct.
Like. All right, let's get back into the mystery element of this week. First of all, we will be discussing some classic Hollywood films. We're going to also regale Francesca with one of our favorite Hollywood true crime stories, which is the death of Salmoneo.
Of course.
Yes. Who was in Rebel Without a Cause with Natalie Wood, which brings us to our interview this week, which is with Lana Wood, the sister of Natalie Wood, who's written a new memoir, Little Sister, and it is juicy.
Mm. Natalie Wood, also just one of these people who is, you know, iconic because of mainly two movies that everybody knows, Rebel Without a Cause and West Side Story. But the more you watch her other movies, you really see that she was like an amazing for Red. She's basically the reason the play The Boys in the Band happened. We'll get into that too. So anyway, lots to discover about Natalie Wood today.
Wow. Yeah.
Truly, I feel like if you have, we've talked about it before on the show, if you have not seen Splendor in the Grass, I feel like that movie was sort of the blueprint for the acting style for a lot of actors after her and Warren Beatty. Like, it was very naturalistic, but also a bit over the top and just sort of like...
That's right. It's the angst was real, but the drama was high. Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My God. Put that on a magnet.
The angst was real. The drama was high.
Or that could be like one of the intros for like a housewife or something. Like, I don't watch those shows, but everybody has like a little blurb that they say. Like, that sounds like one of the...
Ooh, Francesca, I didn't realize you also don't watch those shows. Mm. You need to just stay on the show permanently because I need you as an ally here in this, my life.
Oh.
And to continue the high drama and memoir discussion as well, Will Smith has a new memoir out, and he is getting candid as hell.
It's mind-blowing. Again, so, I never thought we would get this version of Will Smith where we actually knew things about him. I thought he was going to be swathed in mystery for the rest of time.
Honestly, I hate that. I hate that our celebrities feel compelled to tell us everything. Like, I love that I don't know. Like, I don't know what Beyonce's closet looks like. Like, and I love that for me. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, he's telling us way too much. And I mean, I don't know. It just seems very strange, like, especially because he is so successful and he has made so much money. Like, I can't understand what is possessing him to be this open. Like, you know what I mean? Like, is this a weird... like kink
You would prefer he
keeps taking public L's.
You would prefer he table this conversation as opposed to red table this conversation. I got it. Okay.
Yes. Like, get a journal. You know what I mean? Like, what's going on? You
know? Well, we will dig a bit deeper into Will Smith right after this break. So keep listening for more Keep It. Will Smith is currently on a press tour for the release of his new memoir, Will. And boy, oh boy, is he on the press tour of his life. Will is sharing details about his abusive father, his rise to fame, his marriage, past loves, falling in love with Stalker Channing for one.
Excuse me. Picture me, Louis Vertel, when I read that news. Here's me at the computer. You know I'm doing my little typing. What flies across the screen on Twitter? I'm in love with Stalker Channing, end quote, dash Will Smith. What do I do with the rest of my day? Live? Will Smith's in love with Rizzo.
The fact that it also apparently played into like why his first marriage crumbled.
Right.
Yeah.
It's wild. I want to see that movie.
And then, did you see that Stalker Channing responded? She's like, I'm incredibly flattered. Are you?
Oh, wait a second. So is this the first time she heard about it?
Basically, yes.
Oh, that is so messy.
Yeah, Wesley Lowery did the GQ profile of Will, the expansive one that was the precursor to the memoir coming out. And he contacted Stalker and asked her about it.
Wow.
They were, of course, co-stars in 6 Degrees of Separation, which we just talked about recently. Stalker nominated for an Oscar for that movie. Will Smith's first prestige movie project that he was curiously not nominated for. Mm-hmm. And Smith says basically he stayed in character for months or was like method acting his way into falling in love with her, which that is beyond baffling. No idea what he could mean there. But I guess it was ain't no thing to Stockard, who's, you know, just acting up a storm all the time.
I just want to circle back and say method acting, don't get it. This is supposed to be fun. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to be in character all the time. Like, that's not acting. That is, like, you have something
Daniel,
wrong
with Daniel,
take
a day
you.
Off, Lewis, is what you mean.
I just can't imagine that that's fun for anyone in your life or your coworkers. You're being asked to be called your character's name when you're at craft services. Get the fuck over yourself.
It reminds me of, like, in the stories of Andy Kaufman on the set of Taxi, who would be his like alter ego from time to time, and then all the other actors on set would have to oblige and indulge, and then later he would kind of be normal again because he was relatively normal in his Andy Kaufman out of character moments, and then Meryl Lou Henner or Judd Hirsch would have to be like, "No, Andy, that was incredibly annoying. Like, why did you do this to me?"
Yeah, I've never heard. And you know what's interesting is I feel like it's always men that are doing this method acting thing. I don't hear about women saying, you know, Charlize Theron, I'm going to play Monster, so I'm going to be Eileen Wuornos 24/7. I'm out here killing motherfuckers. Like, no one is trying to. It's just very strange. And it seems so. And it's always obnoxious. No one's ever method acting to play Mother Teresa. Right? Like, no one is trying to be a good, loving person and say, let me be that character in my off hours.
For women, I feel like we always hear from a director or their co-stars that they're amazed at how they can be laughing and having fun with people, you know, like on set. And then as soon as the cameras start rolling, they shift into
the
character.
Yeah, that's acting.
And I'm like, that's acting.
The way Meryl Streep does her job and then is also considerate, how does she do it?
Also, side note, before we jump back into Will Smith, this is a classic keep it detour. where's Phil Keoghan coming up with the sign? It's like, a keep it detour is when Ira and Lewis start discussing something else that is off topic. I cannot believe that I watched the show Taxi.
Oh.
As a kid. Like, you know, like, there were so many Nick at Night shows that, like, I watched, obviously, but, like, Taxi feels just like the weirdest one to me, and it feels like the whole show feels like a fever dream.
Yeah.
I don't really remember specific episodes, but I remember characters and feelings.
I feel like nothing happened on that show. It always felt very boring to me.
Well, first of all, I mean, something that's iconic about that show, obviously, is the opening credits, which is the rare case of like a pedestrian sort of vibe. It's not like singing the premise of the show to you. It's not, you know, like a energized pop song or anything like that. It's just like, you know, it's sort of like a stroll through New York. And then I will say about that show, even though I think it's mostly a conventional sitcom, it has multiple very memorable characters in that it's like you've got the Louis De Palma, you've got the Reverend Jim played by Christopher Lloyd, you've got Andy Kaufman, you know, so it's like people were, all three of those characters could have been their own show, but they were all mysteriously on this show. Anyway, so that's my feelings about Taxi. And also Mary Lou Henner has apparently the greatest memory of any celebrity who ever lived, which is very important.
Getting back to the idea that Will was saying that he did this method acting, you know, like, and was falling in love with Stockard Channing, he says he'd never use that tactic ever again, but doesn't it then feel like he's basically saying he used that tactic to create Will Smith? His whole memoir is the idea that the construction of Will Smith was sort of a premeditated, purposeful act to create
the perfect
black male Hollywood star, and now he's reached the age where he's like, hey, I want to be a real person.
What? Oh my God. Like, oh, I'm having so many feelings about this because, you know, I've always liked Will Smith, but his persona has always felt very calculated. And I don't know, I feel so conflicted about the fact that he's telling us this because it almost makes me look back on all the things I liked about him with fresh eyes. Like I feel like I've been lied to by a man that I don't know.
I thought we were friends or we don't know each other. Yeah.
Well, you know, he is a Libra. So, I would say that Will Smith also, it makes sense now with like these weird contradictions that always existed with him. Cause right now he's making that film Emancipation.
Oh
right?
God.
And he was like, I never wanted to make a slave film. You know, it's why I turned down Django. Like
Get
I wanted to be
here.
Like a Tom Cruise making aspirational, you know, like showing black excellence in films. I'm like, all right, girl. I mean, the role of Django seems more interesting and than, you know, Emancipation. No
Wait,
shame.
Well, I thought it was also interesting that he specifically said, I didn't want to make a slavery revenge film. Like, what? Like, if I'm going to be forced to watch a slavery movie, I need to see some motherfuckers die, right? And I need it to be the bad guys. I don't want to watch just, like, pain and torture. And Django is really gratuitous in that way. But at the very least, to frame it as, well, it's a slave movie that's about revenge, it just, again, it's still kind of playing into that good black person narrative.
Right, and he's discussed that he wants to make films only now that are sort of, aspirational. He wants to make films that, are about black love and, the power of us as people. And I'm like, I don't want an aspirational slave movie.
Yes, right. That's what's weird
from those films.
Well, and like this Emancipation movie, what I've read of it, it's described as like an action thriller slave movie. I don't, what? This,
yes, like... it's the male Harriet Tubman. Basically, he escapes and then he goes back to help other people. It's giving you underground, you know.
Yeah.
But from the Will Smith perspective.
Now, I have a question. No. What was aspirational about Collateral Beauty? Because if I'm not mistaken, that actually set cinema back about 175 years.
I think you're the only person that saw that.
Well, by the way, if you do see that movie, I mean, that is among the classic bait and switch movies that ever existed. Watch the trailer for that movie. You think it is one thing. And you're like, all right, well, and Kate Winslet's here and Helen Mirren, plenty of people I trust. And then you watch the film and it's not at all what you think. And also like three layers meta deep that would never, ever happen in real life. I have no idea what happened with that movie. It's constantly on my mind.
Maybe the movie was aspiring to be a better movie.
They usually are. Yeah.
It's also interesting to hear him talk, about jealousies that he had, which makes sense, I mean, before he became friends with Tom Cruise, he describes being jealous of him because he wanted, that, like, he was the only actor who was sort of rivaling him for, back-to-back successes, et cetera, And then, of course, they became friends. It's interesting that he became friends with him during his, like, problematic, like, outbursts. And he describes himself as like, I'm like, don't call me when everything's great. Call me when, I love being a 2 a.m. emergency phone call. And he talked about, and like Bridget Moynihan in the interview talks about how like he reached out to her after like when she was pregnant. I found out she was pregnant after the Tom Brady split. And I'm just sort of like, maybe he's the kind of person who just can only be around other people when they're miserable.
But that also sounds like it's feeding his ego of like, I want to know when things are bad in your life so I can feel better about myself.
Yes, of being savior, Will,
Oh, yeah. It seems like he has a really hard time gauging like normal human interactions. I thought so much of the stuff he talked about with his marriage with Jada was really interesting. Did you see the anecdote where he, for her 40th birthday, commissioned a documentary that traced
about her life,
traced her lineage. Traced her lineage back to slavery. Who wants to watch that during their 40th?
It must be my birthday. You're tracing me back to slavery.
He's like, I don't want to do any slave movies, but I definitely want you to think about slavery at this turning point of your life.
That is wilder than like the show This Is Your Life. This is the person you're married to commissioned a documentary about your lineage and surprises you with it on your birthday. That's also another movie I want to see. That's a horror movie.
And he traced it back to the descendants of the family that owned Jada's family and had them featured in the documentary. Why would I want to hear from those people during my birthday? Why can't you just do the regular thing where everybody's kids, get on the iPhone and say how much they love you, Jada? No, he had to do this weird finding your roots thing for her. Like, just so strange.
This is actually calling to mind for me the kind of intrigue I felt a few years ago hearing Tiffany Haddish tell that now very famous story of like going with Will and Jada on that swamp tour that she got on Groupon or whatever. Because a part of me was super entranced by the idea of Will Smith having to interact with strangers, you know, like, because she takes them on the boat and then he like immediately settles them down and she's like, okay, I'll take a couple pictures, whatever. But it's like, I realized I had no sense of how Will Smith could at all interact in a normal way with anybody. And now this book is sort of validating, oh, that is coming from a very legitimate place for me.
Yes. You know? He's been famous. Yes. He's clearly been famous for way too long. And so I just don't think he knows how to function as a normal person. And I would even argue that the amount that he's disclosing about himself speaks to that. This is not stuff I want to know about people I'm actually friends with and like. Like, don't tell me all of this personal shit about
The merit stuff is maybe good. What was concerning was the foray into, you know, the violence that his father inflicted on his mother. And you know what? He talked with his mother, and that I see that as something that's helpful. Him talking about him coming from, you know, like an abusive childhood and how he survived that and how his family did. But then we go a little bit too far when he discusses how he had thought about killing his father and how if he called 911, it would be his Academy Award winning performance and he wouldn't be arrested. Because, like, how are you going to arrest me? I'm like, I don't know, because you black.
Oh, my God. Well, and that
I don't think he would have gotten away with that. But that his mind thinking that he could get away with that is wild.
Yeah, that really plays into his idea of, like, I'm not like the other blacks. It's just, he seems very detached from reality in a way that is very concerning.
It's very Tom Cruise-y.
Yes.
Who I love. And I love Will too. It's weird. I've always associated their careers a bit with one another too, because they're people who created these sort of like affable personas, right? And then we've seen Tom's, you know, sort of marriage and stuff fell apart more so, I think, because of the Scientology, how deep he was, and also the fact that, you know, like Will Smith, I think, as we see from his upbringing and like also being black, he wanted to be the talented 0.00001%. He had more at stake to not let it all crumble. We've only started to see it once like August Alsina revealed the affair things, and then like Red Table Talk took us into that. But until then, their careers were very much sort of this interesting idea of a male celebrity in Hollywood, because they made commercial, very successful films. And then their brief forays at times into wanting that legitimacy, the Oscar, the nomination, etc., are sort of similar to me too. But what's also weird is that neither of them got those Oscars. Although I would argue that they've both done at least two roles that deserve them.
Which ones?
Tom more so.
I mean, no. You got to back that up.
I would say one potentially for Magnolia.
For Magnolia. And you know how I feel about Jerry Maguire.
Okay.
You're shading Jeffrey Rush today. Okay, that's not an argument I was prepared to get into, but I will defend Shine.
All right, you're the only one doing it.
Armin Mueller-Stahl, we say your name.
I don't know. I just feel like those characters aren't stretches. And I think that if you win an Oscar, I mean, look, I'm not in the Academy, so who am I? I'm truly just a girl with a mic in her office. But I think that you should be stretching yourself and doing something that feels like you have really embodied a new person. And to me, I'm like, Jerry Maguire, like, that feels like, I don't know. Like, he was acting. He gave us some, you know, tears and stuff. But I don't know. He's just playing Tom Cruise.
I would say it's a little bit comparable to like a Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, where it's like, she does have an accent in that movie, but affability is her whole thing. So it's like the Sandra Bullock show is basically that movie.
Right.
Will Smith embodied, you know, a pigeon in Spies in Disguise.
I don't know that one either.
It's a recent animated comedy with Tom Holland, and it's very cute.
Oh my goodness.
You know what's also interesting about these revelations in the book is, I think, the nature of some of these, you usually hear from other people about the person. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm thinking of a memoir I've read 1,000 times because I'm obsessed with them. It's called Split Image. It's about the actor Anthony Perkins. And somebody in it talks about how Anthony has some sort of real life breakdown where he's like crying, et cetera, in front of him. And this person is very compelled by it. And then he goes to see Anthony Perkins in a play later. And he during an emotional scene, literally recreates the breakdown, as in it's clear he was, you know, fueling it like an actor would during the real life breakdown. And then he could recreate it on stage. And this, when Will Smith says, "I could win an Academy Award for my performance on the phone, whatever, as I arrange my father's murder," feels like something almost somebody else would have to say about you, because it's so telling to know about yourself, you know?
Yes.
Yes.
I get that. It's sort of this hyper awareness of the persona that you've crafted. And, you know, I mean, it feels almost relatable in this era of where, you know, like, everyone has crafted their own image.
Yes.
Totally.
You know? And so it's sort of relatable. You know, like, have I planned to murder my father? No.
Do I know that I would look really hot doing it? Yes. Yes.
But do I also know that it's not cute to tell people that now, too? So maybe I have. You know? I did also say, but what you mean about someone else saying it, it was interesting that, you know, like, the memoir doesn't get to much past his marriage troubles with Jada, except sort of address it. He does address the fact that, like, you know, he wanted to let people know that he wasn't also being monogamous, too. You know, it wasn't just her, okay? He was getting some good on the side, too.
I feel like they were the first open marriage that everyone knew about. I've always known that they were open.
Yeah, yeah. There's always the word on the
street. I certainly heard about it. I heard about it a million years ago, but at the same time, I also didn't know where it came from, and I didn't know why they would necessarily be open or whatever. So I had no reason to really believe
it. I feel like it was a childhood rite of passage when you find out. Remember Fresh Prince of Bel Air?
Yeah,
he fucks other people. You know?
Yeah, you know. Yeah, that's just been like, passed around to like black people for years.
Yeah.
I feel like we've always known. I feel like even like my mama knew that.
Yes, my every Thanksgiving we all had to talk about it.
Yes, yes. Like people knew. So somebody from back home in Philly was talking. And that's how it got from Thanksgiving table to Thanksgiving table. But he does talk a bit about, you know, how there's so many other things that he could dive into, but it feels like other people's stories to tell.
Oh.
Also, very funny aside, he almost called Jaden Luigi.
Oh, right. I do think it is kind of chic that the kids have different versions of the parents'
names. I think
that's
like, so cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, like a twist. Especially since if you're taking like, it's a girl and you're taking the man's name and doing something to it. Like if I had a daughter, my dad's name is Lee. I would like a daughter named Lee. I also have a poster of the actress Lee Grant behind me. Anyway, is this all Freudian? Who knows?
Yeah. But no, it was, he talked about how with a psychologist, having his son Trey, the one from the Just the Two of Us video, who I always sometimes, I'm sorry, Trey, as if he's listening to this, forget about him until I remember that Jaden was not even born yet, or far too young to be in the Just the Two of Us video. So not even born yet. There is another son, but apparently it was Trey was going to be involved in the naming process so it could help the blended families. But the name that 6-year-old Trey came up with was Luigi. And so Will was like, absolutely not.
Trying to get that Nintendo money.
Okay.
I do have to shout out Will Smith though for in a few of his main singles referencing, or I guess the word would be interpolating, songs that are so amazing I think people might forget about them otherwise. So first, I mean, besides I Wish by Stevie Wonder, that which is in Wild Wild West that we know, but Forget Me Nots by Patrice Rushen, which is the basis of Men in Black, that is like a banger of all time, and I think I wouldn't hear it otherwise if it weren't for Men in Black now, strangely.
Are
so
you
happy
kidding
about
me
that.
You clearly have not driven around South Florida with my 7-year-old mother. Because that is always on Hot 95. Yes. Like, that's on, like, the...
Yes. Let us not forget him interpolating Rock the Casbah.
And wait, there's another one we're forgetting too. Getting Jiggy with He's the Greatest Dancer by Sister Sledge. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm going to credit his producers, but yes, he is really good. He's really good at yes. taking a song that was already successful and then making another successful song out of it. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I just prefer his version of it to like P. Diddy's, which was around the same time too, oh, I guess. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. like what didn't he do? He put Kashmir in that Godzilla song. And that's a no.
Oh, we're all that trying to forget that song.
Yes. Plus, you know, he was very specific about going back to his persona, right? Very specific about not rapping in his records. Which always reminds me of Eminem saying, "Will Smith ain't got to rap in a song to sell records. Well, I do, so fuck him and fuck you too." to wrap this up, though, in his non-rapping songs, he did manage to have Lil' Kim on a track on Willennium, and the song is called Da Butta, and it is actually a fantastic fucking song.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Will Smith featuring Lil' Kim from
is Lil' Kim being
year, for the year 1999 is PG. You know, it's very much like when she was on Ray J's first single, Wait a Minute.
Wow.
You know, a little PG Kim. It's cute, it's wholesome, it's fun for the whole family. Go listen to Da Butta. It's great.
And it's still relevant because we're still in the millennium. Okay. We're like, we've barely dented it. So you still have time to jump aboard.
Why too hey? Anyway, when the Keep It Mysteries return, we're going to find out what really happened to Natalie Wood on that boat. I promise, like, all the secrets will be revealed in this episode. So keep listening.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Ty Bar. Okay.
Keep It is brought to you by Hinge. Hinge is the dating app designed to be deleted.
If you're really good at it, that is. I've actually met several really good friends through Hinge. I've used it, I can't believe this, over a decade now. Woof, what a life I've had.
Well, you know what they've added within a decade of us being on Hinge is their new LGBTQIA+ prompts, which are designed to help queer daters better connect based on similarities, interests, and compatibility.
Hinge prompts helps you show off your full personality and connect with someone who appreciates you. Plus, these prompts were created in collaboration with GLAAD, so they are by the people, for the people. Some of the prompts are, the first time I knew I was gay was, I was literally in the act of being gay, like hooking up with somebody when I admitted it. Denial is strong and hard in the Catholic Midwest.
Mine was Tom Cruise's Vanity Fair cover, the shirtless one.
You just turned to an imaginary camera and said, I'm gay.
Yeah, or broke the fourth wall.
You're like Fleabag. Other prompts include, I feel proudest of who I am when, it feels affirming when others, blank, I connect to my community by, I wish I could tell the younger version of myself. I'm going to say, whenever I watch that in a Drag Race semifinal, when they're like, if I could talk to my younger self, I would say, I would be like, girl, get tighter clothes. I mean, what's going on with what you're wearing? You look like you're in the X Games. Other prompts include, my chosen family is the best at, and gender euphoria looks like. Download Hinge and show off your full self using their LGBTQIA+ prompts today. Then find someone worth deleting the app for.
Nearly 40 years ago this November, actress Lana Wood lost her beloved older sister, Natalie. The star of classic American films like West Side Story, Rebel Without a Cause, and Miracle on 34th Street, Natalie Wood drowned off the California coast at 43 in a boating accident with her then-husband, Robert J. Wagner, that has been an enduring mystery in the four decades since. In her second book about Natalie's life, Little Sister, Lana dives into the mysterious circumstances surrounding her sister's death and her own investigation into the act that she considers to be a homicide. So, Lana, let's get all the tea right now. We're solving this right here, vitally.
With the book is seriously to let everybody know that if they simply listen to what homicide has put down in black and white and told me in person, what the new coroner has said and what Robert Wagner has said. And Dennis DeVerne, who was an eyewitness, you have the solution. I mean, it goes back to Lieutenant John Carina when he held the press conference when RJ was changed to a person of interest. I'm sorry, RJ is Robert Wagner.
Correct, yes.
Just in case you didn't know. He said, you know, all they know for sure is there were two people on the back of the boat, and then there was only one. Kind of makes things clear cut.
What do you think is the largest just misconception people have about this, you know, utterly sensationalized, I'll call it a crime since we're here we are, that, you know, endures over the years? For example, like, this is completely unrelated, but I am an obsessive fan of Cass Elliot, and still people think she like choked on a sandwich. It's like didn't happen. Like it's like an enduring, ridiculous misconception that is in fact kind of insulting.
Yeah.
Do you have any of those that linger with this case in particular?
I've got so many, it's ridiculous. One of the things that really struck a nerve for me, the whole thing is very upsetting and will haunt me forever. Something that RJ said just got me right in the heart. And I went, no, how dare he? He told the police that arrived on the Splendor that perhaps she took the dinghy out to go to party because she was that kind of woman. What? She would put on a flannel nightgown and wool socks to go and party late at night? Yeah, it just irritated me to no end that he would say that about her. She's not, she would never have done anything like that, even dressed. She would not.
Well, it's so interesting because I feel like publicly one of the things that we famously know about Natalie comes from the production of Splendor in the Grass, where, you know, Aliyah discussed how she was fearful of water and basically had to sort of trick Natalie into filming the scene where she's almost about to commit suicide in the water. And so the juxtaposition of that, it seems like the diametrical opposite. And I also want to ask a bit about, I guess you've discussed that your mother had, you know, sort of visited this woman who sort of predicted, you know, like Natalie becoming a star, predicted the death in like a cold water as where. And what is it just like growing up feeling like there's a prophecy about you? And like, was it a thing your mother mentioned often? Was it a thing that you and Natalie would, you know, like laugh about?
No, it was something that she would do from time to time. She was always telling Natalie her fortune, telling me my fortune, but it was usually in a more direct fashion. But since she was told this as sort of an adult in China, she believed it. And Natalie believed it. It upset her. You know, I left the room and laughed my ass off, but Natalie was upset by it and it hit her. She was far more superstitious than I was, though she was trying to deal with that as well. But yeah, my mom would go on and on about that.
Something also incredibly serious in this book that you cover is confirming the long held, suspicion that Kirk Douglas raped Natalie Wood. How did this story linger in your family? How did it impact her life?
It really impacted Natalie's life. As it is, Natalie was always told what to do, where to go, how to behave. She had, even as a teenager, had that so ingrained that she didn't really know who Natalie was. She just had to be like this. And when that happened, it added another layer of her mistrust, her panic about men in general. A lot of things which would also impact me and her family, because it was something that stayed there, that she had that deep-seated fear that something like this could happen again. It really made her very distrustful, and I think that's why she had the rather odd, you know, she's engaged, she's going to get married. No, she's not. Those issues. And also the thing with Richard Gregson, with her husband, when she caught him cheating, she didn't just scream and yell and say, get out of the house, I'm going to file for divorce, how dare you. She threw out his clothing on the street. She hired security to come and stand in her driveway with a sawhorse. He wasn't allowed to get onto the driveway to drive down to the house. I mean, she really went to some extremes, because she would panic over smaller things, thinking it was some sort of a portent. Well, he's going to be like this always, and I got to get out of there fast because something will happen.
The revelation about Kirk in the book is almost a bit just like the, you know, the boating, you know, incident. You know, it is a thing that has, I feel like, lingered in Hollywood for years, a sort of this unknown secret. And I just sort of also want to know, what was it like for you, and then for even Natalie, as older, sort of navigating this? Was it, would you say that it was a thing that her other contemporaries, other actors, actresses that she worked with knew, and that they just never said anything about it? Was it a thing that you felt like people never really believed, or did people believe this about Kirk Douglas and other women? Was it a thing that people, you know, was an unsaid secret about him at the time?
He was talked about for many other dalliances, and by his own admission was a womanizer. But things were so different back then that if somebody slapped you on the butt or grabbed and gave you a big kiss as you walked into a stage, it didn't mean anything, and it wasn't perceived like that. But what was really Natalie's fear is if anybody found out, she wouldn't have a career, because she would be attacking, per se, a well-known, loved, important Hollywood star. So she lived in fear of anyone finding out. She didn't really have contemporary actress girlfriends. Those were not, that wasn't who she, you know, went to for friends.
Mm-hmm. When would you say that news even first came out? Was it something that you were comfortable admitting after she died, the first time you discussed the Kirk Douglas news?
Actually, it wasn't something that I had thought about. It's something that came back to me in trying to piece together all of the things that happened with Natalie. Mm-hmm. Her reactions, it colored her reactions to things. But Natalie, if you read a couple of pages of her memoir, and I've got 400 pages of it, she would gently refer to things that happened, but she didn't name names, and she didn't openly hold anyone to task. She would hint at what it was and go on. So she was protective, and she was protective of them, and she was protective of herself, because how would she be perceived?
Now, to transfer to, a somewhat lighter topic, Natalie Wood has plenty of films that I guess are now, I would say, are underrated in retrospect. Like, people don't talk about Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice the way they should. You know, The Searchers is still up there, which, of course, you were also in. Do you have favorite sort of underrated Natalie Wood movies? Like, if you had to put one on right now that you hadn't seen 1,000 times, do you know what you'd pick?
It would probably go back to Splendor in the Grass, which isn't underrated. The underrated films. I don't know which were. I mean, I guess the one, I guess Peeper that she made with Michael Caine. It wasn't a terrible movie. Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice really does have a following.
Yeah.
People love that film, and it was terrific for Natalie. It was a big step forward.
Yeah. Oh, it's if you guys haven't seen it, by the way, it's like this, it ends on sort of a hippie-ish note, but it's this like free love movie where everybody in the four main characters each get at least one moment to like really slay on screen. And when Diane Cannon appears, you are like, whoa, this might be one of the best performances of the decade. But Natalie is so sensational too. Looks of course fabulous. Yeah.
That Quincy Jones soundtrack too is exquisite.
Yep.
So.
Yeah.
This is the second book that you've written about your sister's life. What even goes into, one, summoning the courage to write openly and candidly about your sister, and also just how did it feel, you know, over the years? You know, was it a sense that I still need to do more? I owe this to my sister, you know? What's it like going into the process of, I really need to get things permanently on the record about my sister?
I guess it was when I became really overly angry at everything, when things have been laid out, when it's so clear cut. To me, without any of the silly stories, without my, you know, going off on any sort of a tangent, it's there. And for decades now, people have been spinning this way and that way. And it was the Christopher Walken, that she was having an affair with. No, she wasn't. It was a million things like that. Her body was exhumed. They found this and that. And it's crazy. And for people to think that someone who is 5'2" to go over a railing, do they not understand she would have to get up and then fall? It was impossible to fall over that railing. The boat deck, entire thing, had just been repainted with the gritty stuff that they do. So it is rough, but you can't slip. That was done beforehand. That was, you know, Dennis kept the boat in perfect condition. And Natalie insisted upon it. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, I got to the point where I said, you know what? It doesn't sound like anyone is standing up for her. So I have to, as much as I really didn't feel, I felt like I had to do it, but every single memory hurt so badly that I wasn't, this was not a happy book to write. This wasn't reminiscent of, you know, cute little things that the two of us did and, you know, trouble we got into and anything that was really pleasant. To me, I would seriously have to stop, walk away, go for a walk out front, anything for a half an hour or so until I could get a hold of myself again and go, yeah, this is really tough to write. But I really felt I had to because nobody was standing up for Natalie. Not anybody. I mean, her own kids weren't standing up for her. So I'm going to have to. Because at this point, you know, I don't care what anybody says. Facts are facts. I'm not spinning stories. I'm not doing anything. And this was tough. But I stand behind the facts. And I want some sort of justice for Natalie. Some sort. I know what's not going to happen, but I don't know what may happen.
Is it frustrating that there's, because it's such a storied tragedy, and because, you know, suspicions has been cast over the years 1,000 times, that now Robert Wagner is sort of infallible? Like, he doesn't have to, like, respond to any new suspicions. Like, they've already been leveled at him. Is there an extra layer of frustration there?
No, because he constantly changes his story through his own words. You know, people do nothing but look at that. Who changes their story about a death that they were involved in? Huh. Would that be people that are guilty? I think so. You know, the homicide detectives think so. It doesn't matter. You know, RJ has tried so hard to shut me out and shut me up. And even from the very beginning, which I didn't get when Natalie had just passed away, and it was RJ's birthday, and I was worried about him because I thought it would be a tough birthday for him. He had already shut me out. I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that until that evening, and then things that would happen. I was very shocked, but I know it also came back to me through a very good source that he considers me a loose cannon. So he was waiting for me to do something. I just took too much time in doing it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to go off crazy either and start, you know, spouting off about ridiculous things. I needed things a little more concrete than that.
I would say ridiculous isn't the right word I want to use on this topic, but it's also another thing that I feel like has lent itself to the lore surrounding Natalie's death is also we've discussed Hollywood history on this show quite a bit, and the fact that she is in the film Rebel Without a Cause, and then also James Dean's death, and then also Salmoneo's death. You know, was this something that, and you discussed a bit in the book too, you know, that we're friends with Sal, you know, would come over a bit and like swim in the pool with her after the film. Was there
for
some
photo
sort of,
shoots?
Yeah.
Not as
pals. Oh, well, you know, a gay man will always be ready for a photo shoot. So,
yes.
Was there some sense, you know, of that? Was that film and its history, and I guess sort of what would happen to those other two leads, was that something that felt sort of like dark to Natalie or even you, particularly just because you come from a family where your mother would talk about prophecy and things like that?
Right.
Was there this an idea that like this film might be cursed?
I'm the disbeliever.
Yeah.
So I didn't really think about it much. I don't really believe in coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that things can happen that are puzzling like that, because there's more that we simply do not understand about the world, about mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was some reason, if there was some sort of a cosmic force, I am the disbeliever. I'm the one who I'm a certified scuba diver. So, you know, I absolutely love being in the ocean under the water. Natalie was, as has been well established by now, hated it, just absolutely hated it. Every time she had to force herself to do it, it made her a mess afterward, an absolute mess. So.
Now, it should be well established that you have a long acting career yourself. And I guess if I'm going to bother you with one question about that, it's going to be,
okay,
are you often frustrated that Diamonds Are Forever is not credited as the craziest James Bond movie of all time? And are you proud of how zany a movie that is? Because people think it's Moonraker, but it's not. It's Diamonds Are Forever.
Right. It wasn't my favorite Bond movie. Let me put it that way. But I love working with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Guy Hamilton was a friend. Tom Mankiewicz was an old friend. So it was all really nice. And I think, however people perceive it, they're correct.
It's open to interpretation, and you hit your wagon to that interpretation.
Yeah.
And lastly, aside from being a Bond fan, I am also a soap fan, and I have seen reruns of Peyton Place. I just want to know what that felt like, being a part of a series that I felt like was such a springboard for like so many people. You know, you had Ryan O'Neal. You had Mia Farrow on that show. You know, was there the idea during the show that it was really something sort of like special that was gripping America? How do you feel about that show, being a part of it after?
Yeah, that would all be after the show. It's I don't know. I'm very proud to have been a part of it, because I feel that it was a well-written show. They had three directors that would rotate, so we were very consistent. The show didn't go this way and that way. And I adored everybody. Not all the cast, but everybody else I really liked. So I had a good time on it.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And thank you for sharing your story with us, sharing Natalie's story with us. I think that there's one thing that Lewis and I would definitely agree on is, you know, like Natalie has been one of our favorite sort of actresses just stories that we've sort of obsessed over for years. And I hope that the book and this coming out has been able to help you find, you know, some peace with your sister's death as well.
Nope, never will. It never will. Yeah. I just want her remembered. I want her remembered, and this book also serves that purpose, is please remember who she was, who she really was, not made up stories, but really who Natalie was, because she was a real sensitive, hurt person who was looking so hard to straighten out her life, and it was taken away from her. So
thank you so much. Thank you so much, Lana.
Thank you guys very much.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Well, in honor of today's guests, you know, Lewis and I thought it would be fun to regale Francesca with, you know, some of our old favorite tales of old Hollywood murder and some lighter chat about some of our favorite Golden Age movies as well. I think, you know, we discussed Salmoneo with Lana Wood, and he, of course, was one of the co-stars of Rebel Without a Cause, and I think that his death is one that, I feel like his death is my Black Dahlia.
Sure.
Lewis, would you agree?
Well, I mean, the thing about him is, well, first of all, very good actor. And he obviously Oscar nominated when he was 16 for Rebel Without a Cause. He was great later in a movie called Exodus, which was a huge movie at the time that people sort of forget about now. But anyway, the weird thing about Sal Mineo is, so he was stabbed somewhat, I'll call it randomly, in the mid 70s. And you can kind of just walk by where he died here in West Hollywood. So it's just around in a way for gay men, in a, which is unlike, I think, most other, you know, Hollywood stories of lore. I was going to bring up the famous woman who jumped from the Hollywood sign, Peg Entwistle, who was Betty Davis's favorite actress once upon a time. She's only in one Hollywood movie, but the Hollywood sign is
Ryan Murphy's Hollywood.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. He owns the rights to her whole story and all stories now. But anyway, Sal Mineo is just somebody you end up thinking about a lot because you can just walk right past where it happened here. It's just, he was just, it's weird that you could just have like basically the same gay life 50 years ago right over here that you would have now. Like the same people would be around. We're living in the same apartments, you know?
Yeah, you know, I feel like that is the one that has always hooked me just because, you know, I feel like as a person who's such a, you know, like we're writers, you know, so like I love Hollywood, I love stories, and like reading up also on like the history of these actors and people, and then also, you know, as you're coming out as like a gay man and like reading up on people who were in the closet for a long time or when they came out like in that era, you know, I feel like it's one of those stories that I just, the first time I remember reading about it, like I was just very sad for the rest of the day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Especially because and you're realizing or like reprocessing the fact that this person paved the way for gay stars that we have now, you know, like it's not really, I mean, I think it is still a big deal to come out, but it's not the same blow to your career that it was back then. And so like for as sad as it is, it's kind of incredible that we're in a place right now where, you know, you can come out and it's not seen as like, okay, your career is going to be over. No one wants to work with you. You're a pariah. And I think for that reason, it is extremely heartbreaking that his life was cut short.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you haven't read it, a good sort of companion piece to this story is weirdly James Ellroy's description of it. He sort of investigated the case in like 2018 or whatever, years later, like piecing together things from the crime scene and the reports and stuff from the detectives and stuff. And, you know, James Ellroy is himself a very successful author, so you know, him digging into this crime it's a very interesting read, and that's a story that I would love to see, to be honest.
Definitely. Well, also you basically just touched on this, Francesca, but Sal Mineo came out in an interview in 1972 as bisexual, and like the idea, the legend associated with David Bowie acknowledging the same thing and then basically taking it back over the years. This person was not taking it back. This was like his real life. And so there are just not many people like that from that time. So he is utterly irreplaceable in that regard.
Yeah. And I would even add to that, like being bisexual, right? Like there's still this stigma that there's so much erasure of bisexuality, especially in men. It's very much seen as like, oh, you're not really bi. You're just saying that so that you feel comfortable saying that you are gay. And Sal had, you know, relationships with women, like successful, happy ones too. So that definitely can't be discounted.
One that is just, I can't explain why this one is always on my mind, but the 50s Superman, George Reeves, this is a movie, this was discussed.
Yes, I was literally about to think about that one. Wasn't that the Ben Affleck movie too?
Yes, correct, yeah. He just went upstairs at a party, killed himself, or allegedly killed himself. And he's like, for instance, George Reeves is, you might have seen him on the I Love Lucy episode where she meets Superman. That's maybe where most people would know about him now. But it's just... Okay. That level of like baffling, noirish, Black Dahlia Hollywood intrigue history is always coming to mind for me. By the way, we should couch this in, Iris said, our favorite stories. It's not like I'm loving that this happened or anything like that, but it's just, there's something especially resonant about stories like this occurring in Hollywood, which is a very, you know, heated, sexualized, intrigue-filled atmosphere anyway, before you put things like this into it.
Well, it's a bit because, you know, I mean, we see like murder and mayhem every day on the news, right? And there's something about the Hollywood machine. You know, we got into it with Lana, you know, about the keeping up appearances, about like Kirk Douglas, for instance, you know, or like Will Smith discussing, you know, how like he had to be like the perfect sort of actor and really not shed too much about his life. If so much about Hollywood, particularly back then, with the way that stars were crafted without social media.
Yes.
And even like the tabloid news that you would get about them was sort of like negotiated. You know, I still remember the story about how like Tab Hunter stayed in the closet because his manager or whatever like gave the tabloids another actor. Outed another actor to keep his main client, who was successful, in the closet. How it's all about these smoke and mirrors and maintaining sort of like a sort of everything is great here, you know? And so when you hear about like a murder or something salacious like this, you know, it's not like this doesn't happen elsewhere. It's just like it's, wow, it's sort of like a crack in the china glass,
right?
Know?
Right.
Phil Hartman's death, for instance, yes. You know, is another one that haunts me.
Yeah, especially when it's like you were saying, somebody that you have an image of, especially like a comedian. And I even think throughout Hollywood history, it seems to hit even harder when it's someone who you think, but they've been so happy, their mm-hmm. life is so great, they're always making jokes, and it's kind of destigmatizing this idea that like you can have a public happy persona, but that doesn't mean that your life is perfect behind the scenes. And that there are lots of people who are struggling with mental health and drug usage and things like that, that present to us as happy and perfect. It's really kind of jarring when it happens.
There's also an added layer of, I'll use the word intrigue again, with the Phil Hartman thing, because his wife was like a failed actress too. You can see her in bit parts in movies. She's in the movie North for a second. She's in the opening credits of SNL where she's sitting across from Phil Hartman, and as he's looking at the camera and waving, you can see her earring swinging. And the reason is the director told her 2 seconds ago not to look into the camera while they did the scene. So she was trying to have a moment too. So they're actual little haunting glimpses into her character too, or seeming glimpses into her character. But yeah, classic E! True Hollywood story, which, by the way, I was reared on, and children don't have that nowadays, and they just don't know to love and fear Hollywood the way I do. Yeah. Because of this
now,
show.
Now they just have 30-second TikToks.
Yeah,
that are
right.
Diving into people's stories.
TikTok. A TikTok story would be like, have you heard of this actress, Natalie Wood, before? Have you heard of boats?
Right. That's the whole thing. 8 million views.
Explaining what a boat is and explaining, like, Rebel Without a Cause was an iconic Hollywood film you may have never heard of. All right. It was in La La Land. also, North, to get into another Keep It detour, a truly horrendous film that I believe is one of, like, Roger Ebert hated that film, didn't he?
He, in his book, I hated this movie. That's the movie review that is quoted the most often from him, where he literally says over again, I hated this film. I hated every second of it. I hate it. Just somebody on a rampage. Like, it wasn't a normal bad movie for him, which is crazy, because maybe that's what has kept Julia Louis-Dreyfus from doing more movies over the years, is that she was in North and is just traumatized.
There's also this idea of Hollywood murders and like lurid stories like this that like get in the minds of certain people and you never stop hearing about them, like the Manson family, right?
Yeah. Right. You know,
and then it finally culminated in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I hope that that is the last time we have to dive into the Manson family.
No, I feel like we are going to always see movies about that story. I mean, it just has a mix of all the things that people, quote unquote, love, especially like satanic cult, like cults and a cult leader and a movie star whose life is cut short too soon and she was pregnant. Like, there's just all of these elements that make it salacious, but also heartbreaking and fascinating. Not that I think it's appropriate, but yes, I feel like it's always going to be a popular story.
And yet, there's never really been any version of this story that's, like, humanized. I feel Sharon Tate in an interesting way. And that's presumably the reason everyone's so obsessed with it, you know, because this beautiful young blonde actress was murdered while she was pregnant, you know? Like, even I enjoy Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I remember a discussion of it, but I would say that Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate, the depiction of her in the film, I was sort of like, all right.
It wasn't really much of a depiction at all. Yeah.
she went to watch herself at the movies. There's a piece of deep character revelation.
Right.
But I think it also just plays into, you know, like the missing white woman syndrome, where it's not about who the woman is. It's about that she's beautiful and that she, you know, her life was cut short. And it's about how everybody feels about the woman's death and not actually about her. So it's not surprising. I didn't see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm not the biggest fan of, I like Tarantino is not my favorite. So I
wasn't, just say you don't like him. It's okay.
My brain was like, what is this man's name?
I'm the one person who, I guess, who almost every time I try to watch Pulp Fiction falls asleep. Like, the whiz bang actually just does not stimulate me. That's not me bragging.
It's fine. I get it. I honestly, you would be just as well served by watching like a YouTube review of the film of like the best moments, and like, you've got it, you know, like that's it. But yeah, I wasn't running to watch that movie, but I do think it is really sad that we don't know more about Sharon Tate, and we don't know more about who she was versus the most terrible thing that happened to her. Like, that's what cements her legacy for most people. And it's really sad.
Yeah. Second only to being married to Roman Polanski.
Right.
So.
You are correct.
Which must have been a terror in its own right.
I sort of touched on this when I asked Lana Wood and brought up Cass Elliot. But it's sort of like, for instance, something that bothers me is about, I'm an obsessive fan of the Carpenters. Carpenters come up all the time on this podcast. And Karen Carpenter, if I talked about her generally to anybody, what comes up immediately is
eating disorder,
eating disorder, and just maybe even a joke involving Cass Elliot about how if she had shared her sandwich with Karen Carpenter, she'd still be alive or something. It's like, it's so wildly insensitive.
A virtuoso drummer, right? Like, most people don't know she was like this amazing musician.
What 60-year-old are you hanging out with making Cass Elliot, Karen Carpenter jokes?
it's the oldest joke, and everybody pretends they came up with it themselves. But also, Francesco, to your point, I watched an interview with Sheila E. recently, where she talked about how she goes, I always bring up that Karen Carpenter was the first woman drummer I ever watched, and people's responses is always, oh yeah, I guess she did play the drums. It's like, what? Yes, constantly on television.
Yeah, and playing drums and singing together are really, really, that's so difficult. You're keeping track of two very different times at the same time, and that is a skill that most people don't have. And you're right, it totally gets forgotten.
You know what? To rap, you know what mystery most people don't know? Hogan's Hero star, Bob Crane.
Oh, yes.
He was found bludgeoned to death, killed by the third Carpenter sibling, John Henry Carpenter.
Oh, that's too bad. Wow. That's also the subject of the movie, Autofocus, if you don't know about Bob Crane. Yes. That's a pretty crazy story. Very steeped in sensationalism and stuff. So, decide for yourself.
Yes. Oh, also, you all know me, that John Henry Carpenter is not related to Karen Carpenter.
Yeah, he better not be. Yeah.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, what's your Keep It?
I don't know why this article keeps being shopped to me. It keeps populating itself on my Twitter, but keep it to the BuzzFeed listicle. And by the way, my career once upon a time was writing listicles. I have a respect for the art form. Listicle it up, universe. I enjoy it, generally speaking. The article is called 22 Celebrities with No Haters. Another headline for it is, people are calling out the celebrities who don't have a single hater. And honestly, it's an impressive feat. And obviously a bunch of familiar names are coming up, like Julie Andrews, Dolly Parton, Tom Hanks. The point of being a celebrity, or the point of being alive, is not that nobody hates you. In fact, I feel like the thing I hate about this article is it makes people who have haters feel like they did it to themselves. You know who hates Jane Fonda? People I fucking hate. I'm sorry. You know? You shouldn't be congratulated for being benign necessarily. I'm not saying Dolly Parton should have haters. I'm not saying Tom Hanks should have haters, but it's not a crowning achievement. And in a way, it feels to me like a version of sexism that's congratulating women for not annoying men. You know, like we're like, don't, you didn't piss off anybody. Good. You're still on our good side. We haven't turned on you ever. And I mean, let's just talk about the people who get into good trouble. We should be congratulating them more than we should be congratulating people who curiously, somewhat accidentally, don't have haters. Guys, Dolly Parton did not make the Moderna vaccine. Okay. I know she contributed the money. I know you want to believe she was in the fucking lab. She wasn't. Stop. She made wonderful songs and that's enough.
Also, if you're going to talk about Dolly Parton and quote unquote, why she has no haters, you also have to delve into the reason why, you know, a country singer, a blonde one, a gorgeous one, you know, like has such a following in America. Mm-hmm. You should really read Tressie McMillan Cottom's essay, The Dolly Moment, which is on her Substack. That's one of the best long reads I've ever read about the Dolly Parton phenomenon. But getting into that article, Hugh Jackman is on that list. And
what?
Maybe no one at the BuzzFeed offices has ever seen The Boy from Oz, but Hugh Jackman has some haters.
To circle back to Dolly Parton, I do like Dolly Parton, but I'm going to say it. I want to hear from Jolene. Where is she at? Because yes. I'm sure she has some things to say. And it just lends me to believe that BuzzFeed has not done their journalistic duty. Everybody
Paul
has
Rudd.
Haters. Just
right.
Paul existing. Rudd. Yeah, and I, like to kind of piggyback on this whole idea of it being sexist, I also don't think that having haters is an accomplishment. Just existing, somebody is going to have something to say. It's just like when you go home for Christmas and they're like, oh, you think you cute with your little job. And it's like, yes, I have a job. I'm employed. Yeah. Why are you hating on me? Like, this is ridiculous. It's not anything special. Everybody has something to say. And these are just celebrities, to your point, who are benign enough that they maybe don't expose their true personality. They kind of stay out of politics. They stay out of quote unquote controversial issues enough that
they mind their business.
You know, and I'm here for that. I'm here for that. But I agree. We don't need to applaud it. It's not something special.
Paul Rudd's on the list. And literally a few weeks ago, me, Lewis, and I need to drag Paul Rudd for that.
See, watch us. We'll find a way. Well, some of these names too, like for instance, like Julie Andrews, that's somebody who has been mostly out of the limelight over the past however many years. You know, I mean, I don't even know what her last huge moment was outside of the Kennedy Center honors. So it's
people
almost like...
People hated that bitch in the 60s. We don't know.
Yeah, also, like, is she on Twitter? Like, is she someplace that she could put her foot in her mouth? Probably not.
Yeah, right.
Nobody really cared about Joyce Carol Oates until her Twitter fingers got busy. So probably a lot of beloved older celebrities who are still beloved because we do not know what they think about racism.
Yes. Let's keep it that way.
Francesca, you're our guest. Please go next.
Okay.
Keep it. What is your keep it this week?
I'm going to say keep it to people memeing Travis Scott's bad Instagram apology. You know, the Astroworld tragedy is still so, so fresh. There are literally people, children in the hospital right now fighting for their lives. And folks on Twitter are like, what's my hot take on 8 people dying? Now I have to turn it into a meme. Like, no, you really don't. I saw people reenacting Travis Scott's statement on Instagram or doing it on TikTok. It's just very, very tasteless. And look, I get it. Memes are fun. They're like a modern day Mad Lib. Memes make unfunny people seem funny. I get it. But at the same time,
I'm never fooled personally, but go ahead. Yes.
Look, I love memes, but it is the type of thing where you meet, like, have you ever met somebody who's really funny on Twitter and in person, you're like, you have no personality.
Oh, all the time. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Your whole personality is just like co-opting other things that are inherently funny and adding a great caption to it. sure, that's a skill on some level. But at the same time, if your first instinct when you hear about people dying and people being traumatized, right? Like beyond the eight people that died at Astroworld, there are a lot of people who thought that their life was potentially ending, that were mm-hmm. there when it was happening and seeing other people or were being crushed. Like there are people who are going to have psychological trauma from this for years mm-hmm. to come.
Well, luckily, Travis Scott is offering them a month of free therapy with BetterHelp.
Oh, God. You know, and here's the thing. I think this is one of those moments where people believe that they're punching up because they're making fun of, they're trying to make fun of Travis Scott. But this is not a situation mm-hmm. that I think that there's any way to spin this in a funny way. Like he did mm-hmm. something, you know, he was definitely negligent in the situation. There were a lot of people that are to be blamed for this. And I hope mm-hmm. that this, you know,
and it's a thing that he's done before
absolutely.
In the past, you know, encouraged his attendees of his concerts to rage and be crazy. So
absolutely. And they were very much cutting corners in order to maximize profits and have as many people there as possible. They weren't listening to the attendees who were saying that they were in distress. There's nothing funny about that. And mm-hmm. Despite what you might think about Travis Scott's bad apology, and let's all agree, it was bad and it wasn't a real apology at all. I just don't see the benefit. It's like, okay, great. You got a lot of retweets on Twitter. Like, good mm-hmm. for you.
You're right.
I don't know like what the purpose is.
Also, you think this would be funny too, but it is not. The other thing that's happened on TikTok from this is that now this has become the basis for the satanic panic of 2021. Apparently, Travis Scott is the devil and Satan is bad. And let me tell you, Travis Scott is not interesting enough for Satan to care about. Okay,
seriously.
He is not Marlena Evans. Okay. I thought Lil Nas X was the devil before. There's a more interesting pop star. Okay. Anyway. speaking of people who aren't interesting enough for the devil to care about, my keep it goes to Aaron Rodgers.
Oh my God. I can't believe we have time for this. Okay, go ahead.
First of all, this Aaron Rodgers recently got COVID and is missing some games as a Packer. First of all, the Green Bay Packers are the football team from Wisconsin. I'm a Packer fan, okay? So this hits me actually where it hurts. He was not following NFL protocols because he was immunized. He didn't get the vaccine. He was immunized because he had had it before. The thing that made me so upset about this man was, whatever, you're stupid, you're a celebrity who got COVID by not doing what you were supposed to do. That's happened to so many celebrities that we can't even make a list here. But the fact that you then need to jump into the persona of the person who's like, well, the woke left mob is coming after me.
Oh, God.
And then he's also doing this like, politics is a sham because the right is going to champion me. I'm like, you sound like an idiot.
He also fucking said, I'm a free thinker. I march to the beat of my own drum. People who say that, by the way, I'll say it. They don't. I mean, they're lying.
No.
I march to the flower drum song. Okay.
I enjoy being actually immunized and a girl, to quote that musical. But he said, I march to the beat of my own drum. And I'm also following the advice of Joe Rogan. It's like, do you see where there's a conflict here? You can't do both. Yeah.
Every person who listens to Joe Rogan thinks that they are a free thinker and coming up with things on their own.
Yeah. I'm also annoyed by the same crowd that was very, you know, actively shouting, shut up and dribble, is suddenly like really gung ho about sports stars, you know, having thoughts on politics and having thoughts on COVID.
Is it giving hypocrisy?
Is it giving hypocrisy because it's a white man
who's on the side of the right who thinks that getting vaccines is somehow evil? I'm sorry, when you are feuding with Big Bird on Twitter, Ted Cruz, because he's telling kids to get immunized, your brain, half your brain is missing.
Also, I just want to be clear, this man was a half step away from being the permanent host of Jeopardy. Remember when we were freaking the fuck out that Dr. Oz was a bit of a quack and it was crazy that he got that opportunity? Even Dr. Oz isn't calling you the woke mob for wanting you to get a motherfucking vaccine.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Shailene, pick up your man. Yeah.
It would have been so wild if he'd somehow managed to be both of our nemesis for two different reasons, Lewis.
I know. The layers of how awful he is. Oh, my God. And also, by the way, now enough time has passed that we can say he sucked as a Jeopardy host. I cannot stand that people were defending him. He sounded like he could barely read. It sounded like they pulled him out of the audience to read clues. He was like the kid in the play who's holding his script because he's too busy being on the football team. Yeah. Yeah. Awful.
You know, I'm interested now in what's going to be his new trajectory, you know, because isn't it always fun when a rather
he's
going
to go the canceled route.
Right.
Like, this is a moneymaker for them. You say you've been canceled and then you go do a college speaking tour about how you've been canceled. And then you come out with a podcast about how you've been canceled. And then you put out a book about how you've been canceled. And it's just like there's a playbook now, you know, it's like
Never mind.
To use the word woke mob and cancel culture. And then suddenly, like, that's your ticket to success.
Never mind that you're only missing like, what, a couple games, and then you'll go right back to being a millionaire football player who is with Shailene Woodley.
You're fine.
Which is its own sort of cancellation, if we're being honest. Have
Do
fun living
like
in Ferngully.
I enjoy her. That might be a big little truth, though. I don't know.
I like her too. Someone has to save the rainforest.
Yeah.
I feel like she's at the level of like saving the Rainforest Cafe and not the actual rainforest.
Shout out to Rainforest Cafe. That's my shit.
Anyway, this has been the one sports topic that I actually care about. So it won't happen again for another 100 years.
Thank God.
Francesca, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Oh my gosh,
again.
Thank you for having me.
For coming back. Thank you to Lana Wood for revealing secrets. And this has been the Keep It Mysteries. We'll see you next week when we're joined by the Harlem Globetrotters and Phyllis Diller.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night. No matter how chaotic your day is, conquer the bake sale. Even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.